It's not hard, and it's not far to reach, because you and I, we can hitch a ride to Rockaway Beach. Hi, everybody, welcome to the Saptacast. I'm your host, Scott C. Episode 3 to the 7 to the 1 to the nothing. It's episode 37. I don't know. I try to sound cool when I do things like that, and I don't know if it ever works. Now, I'm just not a cool person, maybe. In any case, enough about me, folks. It's about today. It's about this episode, episode 3737. Pamela Taylor is on the program today. But first, before we talk about that, let me tell you a little bit about upcoming events from the Sundress Academy for the Arts. We got some very good fall programming for you coming up right now. September 26th is going to get you in the mood for the Halloween season as Sundress has its next workshop. And this time, it's all about writing urban legends and ghost stories. Indeed, the stories that we grew up hearing. I don't know what stories you heard. I know the ones I heard. Maybe I even created a couple about my neighborhood, about that one weird house that nobody goes to, and Howard the Duck was in a camouflage pair of pants and a shiny green jacket like Scooter on the Muppets, and he was wandering through somebody's backyard, terrorizing the children. Anyway. My memories, not about that. It's about your memories and about what you think. And how do you take these stories and revamp them or retell them in a great way? Leading the workshop is the one and the only Emily Capitini. She is a great writer, and she is more than qualified to talk about this subject. It's all going down Saturday, September 26th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at Firefly Farms, the home of the Sundress Academy for the Arts, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. Tickets are available for this, but they are going fast right now because there are already a number of great writers and even a couple former guests on this program are even going to be there, as I am told. But that is, again, Saturday, September 26th, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Sundress Academy for the Arts, just outside Knoxville, Tennessee. For tickets and information, you can, of course, go online and find it at sundressacademyforthearts, that's all one word, .com. And you can also find it through the Sundress store at sundresspublications.com and clicking on SAFTA. Hey, another thing that gets you in the mood for Halloween, kind of, sort of, at least in terms of environment, perhaps even in terms of the writing itself, I want to bring it up again, brought it up a couple weeks ago, the first ever nonfiction writing retreat, which is going to be taking place on October 16th through the 18th, also at Firefly Farms outside of Knoxville. And the leaders of this workshop for that weekend are truly two amazing people. We've had them on this show before. Sarah Einstein and T.A. Noonan are going to be leading this one. This is not to be missed, my friends. It is truly going to be wonderful if you are interested at all in working on nonfiction, creative nonfiction. How do you tell your story? How do you go beyond simply just, this is what happened to me when I was 12 years old? Now, I don't know why I'm speaking in an old man voice when I'm talking about being 12. Anyway, my point is, you can pick up a lot of great tricks and information from this. Check this out again, October 16th through the 18th at the Sundress Academy for the Arts, just outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. Tickets are also available for that. A wonderful weekend of learning about writing, but also enjoying great company and enjoying the great outdoors in early fall, just before the real cold starts to settle in. You get to see the beautiful mountains as they are afire with the beautiful, beautiful change in leaves and the scenery there and the gorgeous surroundings that make up Firefly Farms. Definitely two events worth checking out, worth your time, worth your eyes, worth your investment. Today, we have Pamela Taylor on the program, data analyst by day, poet by night, and all-around badass and truly cool person to hang with. It was a great pleasure to have her on this program, and as you will see, as so often happens on the program, we get into some really cool stuff to talk about. Some of it a little bit heavy, some of it a little bit lighter. We explore why the Fitbit is popular with her and her family. We also explore the Argentine tango a little bit, an area of knowledge that I am lacking in, but now I may be intrigued to find a local dance studio around me. Who knows? We also talk about the differences of living in New York versus Los Angeles and the importance of vetting your dates, which is a topic that I have a suspicious feeling now may come about, say, 5 months from now on the program. Keep your ears locked for that, and keep your ears locked on this program throughout the fall, because I can tell you right now, the slate of guests we have for you over the next few months is going to blow your mind, and it all begins today with, as I said, Pamela Taylor. So strap in and get ready, because it's a fun, lively interview today with the one and only Pamela Taylor. Let's get to it right after we get to the theme song.
Scott, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you?
I'm great.
It's good to hear. So glad we could find a chance to do this and talk for a bit.
Yeah, definitely. And it was like, I was trying to get in my Fitbit step before you called, and I just made it.
Yes! Did you like walk up an extra flight of stairs or just like run around the room a couple of times?
Yeah, that was pretty much it. I got home. I was about 1,000 shy, so I sort of walked around the neighborhood and then got in the house, and I still had maybe about 200 left to go. So then I just walked around the living room.
Just start pacing, you know.
It's so true. It's Pavlovian, because all you're doing is trying to get to, you know, the 10,000 step buzz. And you're like, woo, when it happens.
What are the benefits of hitting that 10,000? Do you get a little reward, or is it just psychological?
At this point, it's psychological. But when I first got it, I guess this is back in April, they send you all these cute little badges. So you get the boat shoe when you do like 500 steps, and then you get more as it goes on. I mean, I've got whatever badge was like 25,000 steps in a day. That was out when I was hiking in Utah. There's this sort of lifetime, like 70,000 steps, which is like the Penguin March. It's, you know, so they keep you going with all these little badges. And then lately I've gotten into these like weekly challenges, mostly with my mom and my sister. And so then it's just about, you know, beating them.
What are these weekly challenges? Because I'm not really an adopter of the Fitbit.
So there's this thing called the Work Week Hustle, I want to call it. So it's just for the total who has the most steps to the 5 days, you know, for the 5 days in the work week. And with all of us on Fitbit, you can see who's, you know, who has more steps, who's getting close to you. You can see it, you know, everybody and where they line up. You know, sometimes my mom gets up really early. And so sometimes I'll wake up at 6 and I'll already have this message, Maddie has already chalked up 900 steps. I'm like, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, lady. What are you doing?
It's like, I haven't even had a cup of coffee yet. Come on.
I haven't even rolled out of bed when she's already walked 1,000 steps.
It's like, where are you going at 6 in the morning?
She gets up really early.
Yeah. Oh, were you one of the early adopters of the Fitbit?
I don't know when it started. I mean, I got mine in late March, early April. So I don't know. I don't think I was an early adopter, but, you know, I definitely got other people on it. That's for sure.
Like your mom and your sister?
Yeah, I got them Fitbits for Mother's Day. I mean, I think before Fitbit was just the pedometer that you clipped on, but since they made this thing that's more of a wristband, it looks like a watch, that's when I started doing it. They have one where it's just lights, things that light up, but the one that I have, it has the time, it has how many calories that you've done, how many steps, how many miles, how many floors. So it's a little bit more information that you can see.
Back in my day, it was just this little counter on your belt.
Yeah, back in my day, we didn't even care about how many steps we took.
Back in my day, that was the thing the guys wore in the suburbs on the belt, and they're like, look at my pedometer.
But now it's like, yeah, I mean, it does really make me think differently about, okay, well, if I park, I don't have to park so close, I can get some steps, it's okay. You know, I don't have to drive down there. Even when you go out of your way, you're like, at least I got some steps.
I take it then from that you're a bit of an active person.
Yes. Yes. Mostly, though, I do yoga, and I also do Argentine tango.
Argentine tango. That sounds so specific when you say it. Argentine tango, because my brain immediately goes, okay, I know of the tango.
Right. People think of, like, ballroom tango and the flower in the mouth, that type of thing. But I mean, Argentine tango is really all about close embrace. So you get really cozy with a lot of people in a night.
So what differentiates it from the tango as like the populace might know it? Is there anything that makes it specific, makes it Argentinian tango?
I think ballroom tango is, or American tango, it's about certain steps, certain patterns, whereas Argentine tango is completely improvisational. So when I get asked to dance, even if it's a leader that I've danced with many times, even if it's music that we've heard many times, the dance is always going to be different because it's like whatever he wants to do or whatever on the floor or you know, it's always a different dance. And as a follower, you just never know what's going to happen and you just have to roll with it, which is initially for any independent woman, it's really hard to do, to really trust your leader to lead you and not, you know, run you into the next person because you're walking backwards in high heels. You know, there's a lot of trust. And so Argentine tango helps you work out some of your trust issues. But it's just a little bit more, I think it's more sensual because it's really about the connection between you and your partner. I mean, you don't really even have to do a lot of fancy steps to have a really good dance. I mean, they could just be walking, doing simple stuff, but as long as the two of you feel connected, it's the best thing ever.
It's like the connection between the partners, but also it sounds like the connection between you and the music. It's like wherever the music takes you, go with it.
Yeah, that too.
So how did you fall into Argentine tango?
Oh, man. You know, I started taking classes pretty much when I got this job. So it was about almost 8 years ago. And I was working on a project at my previous job. And the person there, who was sort of like the project manager, kept saying, he's like, I think that you would like tango. He danced tango in New York, and I was down here in North Carolina. He said, you would like it. You'd like it. You know, it's an elegant dance, and it would fit you. And when I left that job, he made me promise to take a tango class and then went even further and found a class for me to take down here. And so I promised him I'd take a class and that, you know, I was like, okay, it's only 4 weeks or 6 weeks or however long it was. It wasn't even that long. And I've pretty much been in tango ever since. That was 2007.
Hey, whatever works. Were you into dancing of any type really before that? Had you taken like dance lessons as a kid or anything?
Oh, not as a kid, no. My mom paid for piano lessons. That's what I got.
So all of your dancing then was informal?
Yeah, all my dancing was informal. I had taken some Latin ballroom classes back when I lived in LA and had taken one tango class that was both American and Argentine. The teacher taught us both, but really didn't, you know, follow up with it until I got here. But, you know, I love dance. Sometimes you just got to go out and shake your booty, you know. But, you know, it's just more controlled.
I don't know if I can subscribe to that as a person who has no rhythm. I had to learn how to dance for my wedding because mine boiled down to there's like one move I've got, and I learned it back in high school from watching ska bands and punk bands.
Okay.
And it's not much. Well, hats off to you on that, because I got no skill. I was the only DJ in my company when I worked for a company that would not do any of the dances.
Oh, well.
It's like, all right, we're going to do the electric boogie. I always have to say that because I think it's not the electric slide. It's the electric boogie. I would not do it. I'd be like, okay, play. And then I'd just stand there.
Oh, that's too bad. I really love dancing. I like moving. You know, I think that's also why I like yoga. It's moving my body in a different way. I actually thought about taking fencing, but I just don't have the time to fit everything in. But so it's just really yoga and dance right now. I took an Indian dance class once, which was super fun because it's a little bit like hip hop, but it's like not as like hip hop is like overtly sexy, whereas like Bhangra and Bollywood dancing is sort of, you know, playfully sexy. And so it's just a little bit more demure.
It's like a little more flirtatious kind of dancing.
Definitely more flirtatious, you know, and sometimes you're just like out there to have fun. You're really not trying to, you know, attract negative attention.
It's about positive energy.
Absolutely.
I can see that. I've watched some Bollywood videos and some music videos over the years, like Dollarmendi and such. And you see that flirtatious, that coyness, but not overt.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so that's why I really enjoyed it.
Beyond yoga and dancing, you sound like you've always been an active person, though.
I'm wondering, have I always been an active person?
Like you mentioned hiking.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I really don't like hiking. I have a friend, she's a rock climber, and, you know, she loves outdoors. I mean, she knows to ask me, do you want to go walking outside? Because hiking just, like, immediately I put up my defenses. But some places you can only really experience by hiking through it. And, you know, Utah is one of those places. I went to Arches National Park and then Bryce and Zion. And it's just amazing. It's completely amazing to, you know, each one of the parks is different, different personality. I went in April, so Bryce Canyon is at this high altitude, so there was still snow on the ground in certain places. Certain trails we couldn't go on because it was, you know, iced out or just too dangerous for people to walk through. You know, and I've always wanted to experience those places. Arches was definitely on my bucket list. So I knew that the only way that I could do it is to hike through it. So, you know, it's more like the sacrifice I knew I needed to make in order to see the places that I wanted to see. Now, I'm probably good for hiking for another 3 years, at least. Because I was like, I'm so done. I mean, it's like, it's a lot of walking. As beautiful as it was a lot of walking. But, you know, I had a really good appreciation for a couple of things. One, just the beauty of nature and the different terrain of the United States. Because, you know, living in North Carolina, there's a lot of trees. It's a beautiful place. But, you know, in a green way, whereas Utah is just a beautiful place in a dry desert, red rock kind of way, which is completely different than what I see. And then I just was also tripping off the fact that, like, I was still in America. I mean, it looked like Mars sometimes, but it was like, it was America and my tax dollars went to this. And I was so happy about that. You know, it kind of makes you feel like, you know, April 15th is not that bad of a deal every year if you know that this is where your money's going to.
Constantly stunned. I've traveled a lot through America, at least the eastern half of it. I always say that there's only like two times I've been across the Mississippi River, but I am stunned that I can go 100 miles and suddenly the terrain is completely different.
Completely.
I'm in Florida where it's all flat land. There's no hills, nothing. You've just got the sun of death staring down on you. Last couple days down here, it's been a heat wave and we've been in a heat index of well over 100 and lower humidity. So it's just been this angry, violent sauna outside. You know, a walk from your car to your office and you have 5 gallons of sweat on you and you're like, kill me now.
Oh gosh, I know. Gosh. Living in the South, that'll do it to you.
But I can go up to Georgia and suddenly I'm back in the mountains.
Mm-hmm, that's right. Yeah, I mean, like, even North Carolina's like that. You know, Asheville is mountainous, and then, you know, you get down to the coast and the beach, and it's just like, you know, all different terrains in just one place. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, and I lived in L.A. for 12 years, so I was used to desert heat. I mean, and I was used to, like, not really that much change in temperature. You know, it's like, 60s to 85. You know, if we got above 90, we were all complaining.
Well, now you're in North Carolina. I'm sure you have your share of 90 degree plus days.
Oh, yeah, that was today and yesterday. And no, maybe not the day before that, but the last few days has been really almost oppressive. The heat coming out of the buildings. I mean, they keep the building super cold. And I don't know if you've, like, seen that article maybe in the New York Times about how the temperature was basically set for middle-aged white men in the 60s and hasn't really changed from that. So,
yeah, I've had many experiences even during the summer here where I go into class or I go into work and I bring a sweater with me, a light sweater. Oh, and I'm always like, why am I bringing this? Because I'm standing in 100 plus heat going, why am I carrying a sweater? And then I go inside after an hour. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is why I brought a sweater.
Yeah, I keep my little space heater on, my illegal space heater on pretty much all summer, pretty much all year, actually, but definitely in the summer because it just gets really cold. And today was one of those days where I needed a sweater and a shawl to put over my legs because it was that cold inside. But when you walk outside, you're just stripping off everything.
On one hand, I can understand aggressive air conditioning, and I am thankful for it. But at the same time, yeah, I saw that article come through a couple weeks ago or so. It just passed by on my feed. And I was like, huh, I always wondered about that.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, I guess if you're wearing a dress shirt and a suit jacket, you need a temperature a little bit cooler than, you know, if you're wearing a summer dress, which is, yeah.
And you can't take off that shirt and tie and jacket either.
Exactly. Well, you can't take off the summer dress either. Yeah. Not the workplace.
At least most workplaces you can. Right. I think you're taking advantage of our casual Friday.
Oh, gosh.
You know, like movie theaters, I know, are also cold, but there's actual science reason for that, and that is that cold helps you digest food better.
Why, to get you to go to get more popcorn?
It is, because when people talk about it, they usually say, I'm going to dinner and a movie. So you go to dinner, then you go to the theater, you digest faster to hit the concessions.
Oh, I didn't know that.
There's a lot of subtle tricks that movie theaters use. It's not uncommon to still do this, to pump the smell of the concession stand into the theaters.
You spend as much of the concession stands as you do on the movie itself. It's just ridiculous. Well, I used to go to movies a lot more often. I mean, gosh, when I lived in LA, oh my gosh. Now that is the one thing, you know, I've lived in Durham for almost 9 years and, you know, I was in LA for 12 years. And that is one of the biggest things I missed about LA is going to see pretty much any movie that came out that got reviewed was immediately released in Los Angeles. You could walk down to Santa Monica and see whatever. You can see the artsy film. You can see the blockbuster film. That was like all in three blocks. And then there were still people giving out tickets to preview movies before they came out. I mean, I really miss that. Here is, I mean, we're lucky to get the movie for a week, you know, if it's something, you know, like that movie, there's a movie that's out. I still have to even check if it got down here yet with Lily Tomlin, the grandma movie.
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about.
Right. So I'm dying to see that, but I don't think it's come down here yet.
Yeah, I don't think it's playing near me either. Mm-hmm. It's a shame, too. With all the streaming media and everything that we have, we don't have access to certain things.
I know.
Breaks my heart. When I grew up in New York, I grew up in a town where we had an art theater that would bring in foreign films and lower release. I saw, like, what was it? I think it's David Lynch, Lost Highway.
Okay.
Came there, and Bound also came there. You know, it was a blockbuster, but it wasn't. And
that's right.
So you were in LA for a long time. How did you wind up in LA?
I went there for grad school. Yeah, I went to UCLA for grad school. I have a PhD in social psychology. So that's actually like my, I wouldn't say, I guess it was my first love, and then writing came. But yeah, I definitely was out there, and then when I finished up, I stayed and I worked out there for another 8 years.
Where are you from originally?
Oh, I'm originally from New York City, from Far Rockaway.
Ah, Rockaway.
Yeah.
I'm familiar with it from a Ramones song.
Oh, I know. Everybody says that. Everybody says that. Yeah.
I'm going to show my ignorance because I'm from upstate. Where is Rockaway?
Okay, so it's actually not too far from JFK.
Okay, so it's in Queens?
Yes, in Queens. It's in, I guess it's considered southern Queens, but we're also, it's a peninsula that's sort of connected to Queens as well as a part of Long Island called Five Towns. And so you can get there via like two bridges or this subway. For the most part, or, you know, if you go through JFK, there's this road that'll sort of take you that way. But Far Rockaway, which is more closer to Long Island, and then there's, but the, you know, the beach and the boardwalk, you know, spans almost the entire peninsula. So a lot of people, when they go down to Rockaway Beach, They usually cross the, Gil Hodges Bridge, sort of through Flatbush. And then the beaches are like Reese Park and all that. That's are right there when you get off the get off that bridge.
So you grew up there in Far Rockaway, and then as a child and everything. How was that? Were they good? Do you look back with fondness, or like, oh, thank goodness I'm out of there?
I think now I'm realizing that Far Rockaway or parts of Far Rockaway were really rough, but I don't think that I felt that it was any rougher than any part of New York. I mean, I grew up in New York in the 80s, okay? So, I mean, New York was just not a good place to live in the 80s. This is like when the trains weren't working and everything was had graffiti, and Times Square actually, you know, had all more XXX places everywhere, and like people in alleys shooting apparent. I mean, it's just like New York in the 80s was bad. Just all of it was bad. So I didn't think Far Rockaway was any worse than any other part of New York, right?
Still better than the Bronx at the time.
Right, exactly. And so, I mean, and then we had the beach, you know? We still had the beach and the boardwalk. So that made it, you know, really different in that it still felt more like the suburbs than the city itself. I mean, yes, there was, like, you know, we heard about, like, our neighbor once, you know, people try to steal her jewelry off the train and, you know, stuff like that happened. But like I said, I didn't think it was any different than the rest of New York. And I kind of liked growing up there, particularly the beach and the boardwalk. And that was just sort of different than the rest of Manhattan. I mean, I grew up in my parents had a house. We had a basement. So it wasn't like the projects and apartment living. So, you know, none of that is, you know, I don't know anything about that stuff, but at the same time, you know, it was kind of far from everything, but I didn't think of anything different of it, you know?
Did you grow up with siblings?
Yes. I have an older sister and a younger brother. And this is like, my sister is 6 years older than I am, and my brother is 3 years younger. So there's a 9-year span. And so, like, here, this is like the only time we're all in our 40s, you know, until my sister, like, crosses over that threshold next year.
Was it difficult on your parents to have that 9-year separation between the three siblings?
I never asked them that question. I have to ask my mom. My dad is deceased. You know, my mom at one point, she wanted like 6 kids. And then my brother came along. And so then she was like, I'm just going to stop right here. Yeah, well, he kind of was like, destroyed everything, like everything. We had a toy horse that you could ride. Broke that. I think the crib he broke, you know, all kinds of stuff. He was just very destructive, but he's probably just very boy. And when you have 2 girls, you know, and you think, oh, this was that bad. And then the third one comes along and is completely different. You're like, oh, I wasn't prepared for that.
I wasn't ready for the third one.
But it was definitely cool growing up with siblings. But, you know, when my sister was 16 and I was 10, that was probably the biggest way of me feeling the difference between us. But now it's like when you get older, the years seem shorter, you know, or they don't seem as big of a gap developmentally.
Neither of you can really relate to each other at that age.
Right. But then your sister, so you want to confide in each other. But then, like, what she's confiding in me about, I'm like, I don't know. Like, you're talking to me about boys. And I'm like, I haven't really, like, wait, you touch them? What? You know? Right. It's like, wait, what does that mean? You know, so.
And she's looking down on you going, why are you bothering me with a 10-year-old's problems? You know?
Right. Exactly. You
know, I got the dance to worry about this weekend. And meanwhile, your little brother is just like, I have no interest in any of this. I'm just going to break something.
Right.
Hopefully he's not as destructive as he was as a child.
You got to ask his wife that. No comment.
We'll plead the fifth on that one.
Right.
So you stayed in New York then for a long time. Did you go to school there for a while, like college and such, before you went to LA?
No. As soon as I figured out, it's probably like junior year in high school, that I did not have to live in New York, I was like thinking of leaving. And at first I had wanted to go to Berkeley, but my mom was like, oh, that's just too far. So I ended up going to school here in North Carolina at Charlotte at a historically black college, Johnson C. Smith. And I loved it. But, you know, I've not lived in New York ever since. Like, I went to Johnson C. Smith for 4 years. I did grad school at UCLA, and now I'm living here. So as much as I love growing up in New York, and I'm very thankful that I grew up in New York, I don't want to live there. I don't want to live there.
Totally understand. I go to New York City, and I love to visit. I don't think I could live there.
Right. Particularly when I lived in L.A. I mean, because L.A. is just so... Have you ever been?
Not yet. I'm hoping maybe next year, but we'll see.
Okay, well, for AWP or something like that.
Yeah, I'm thinking about it. I'm on the fence right now, as I think many writers are.
Yes, yeah. But, I mean, L.A. is just so, I mean, for as big as it is, it's just so laid back. They really don't act as if they have 4 million other people around them. You know, everything is just so loose. Flying back from Los Angeles to New York, I had to get up to speed, you know? Like, that level of vigilance when you go into New York City, you know, you just sort of ready for anything and everything that happened to you. Like, it probably won't happen, but you got to sort of be prepared and be on the lookout for it and assume that people are not going to help you. You know what I'm saying? So it's just,
oh, yeah.
It just has started taking me so much energy to ramp up to New York speed. I was like, I can't do it. I really can't do it anymore. And, you know, now that I live in North Carolina, where it's like, if, you know, we like that we're slow. We like that we take our time. We like to have, you know, minute-to-minute exchanges with the person who is, you know, checking us out of the grocery store line. That's like, there's no problem. Small talk and asking about your mom. I mean, oh, Southerners love that. That's just the way that we are, you know?
I've had that experience too. I grew up in New York, where you shield yourself in this invisibility cloak that prevents people with clipboards from ever coming near you in public.
Mm-hmm.
You never look anyone in the eye.
Right.
You know, and if anyone gets near you, you just kind of shoot them a look that has the word fuck in it somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I moved to Mississippi for grad school, and my first experience is I'm walking down a staircase in a hotel, and I was in the wrong place and bumped into the person, and they looked at me and went, sorry. And I was like, why are you apologizing to me? What the fuck? And I slowly learned, oh, wait, this is a whole different world I gotta adjust to now.
Gotcha. Yeah, I remember when I went to college and, you know, from New York to North Carolina, and, you know, people would say, hey, on the street, you know, just because the campus had dorms across the street. And I just assumed that those people were talking to, you know, you walking and people are walking in the same direction. They're talking to people around me. They're not talking to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then my roommate, who was from Jacksonville, Florida, she was like, you know, people think that you're stuck up. And I was like, why? And she's like, well, when they say hey, you don't say hey back. And I was like, I grew up in a place where you don't talk to people on the street, you know? And so, you know, that was like my first lesson is like, gosh, when in Rome, man.
You have to adjust a little bit and, mm-hmm. you know, accept, hey, okay, people want to chat. Or where I was in Mississippi, everything closed at like 11:30. Mm-hmm. Everything closed for like 2 hours. And I'm sitting there going, but this is when I got to get stuff done. Why is the bank closed? And why is the post office closed? And why is the grocery store closed? Seriously.
You mean 11:30 in the afternoon?
Yeah, 11:30 in the morning. Suddenly everything like shut down for lunch. And I'm like,
oh, for lunch.
Like, seriously, I got to get stuff done, man.
The Southern siesta.
So as a kid, then you took piano lessons. Do you still keep up with piano, or is that kind of one of those things that just kind of faded away?
Well, it faded away, and actually at one point, I'm saying this as I'm looking over my shoulder to my piano, so I have a piano, and I took lessons maybe now it's probably like 5 years ago. When I was living in Durham, just to sort of learn it again. Because when I was younger, I had a photographic memory. It's not as good as it was before. So I think I memorized where the notes were, but I never really learned how to read music. So I was going back and really learning how to read music. But I just haven't gotten back to piano, even though I still would want to. I mean, you know, my mom took piano and she can still sight read. and play something, which I think is amazing. I mean, I still kind of want that skill. It's probably like a bucket list skill for me as well.
That's on my bucket list as well as tap dancing.
Oh, why tap dancing?
Simply because I think it could get me out of any trouble I'm ever in.
Oh.
you get into any trouble, all you have to do is go, well,
yes.
Are they really going to do anything to you because you're tap dancing? And probably not. So I figure it's the perfect getaway skill. Are there other things on your bucket list that you want to do in life? Because you mentioned a couple of the state parks and get back to piano. Are there other things on there?
You know, at one point I wanted to, you know, no, I still actually want, I was thinking at one point I wanted to be in every state, but there's some states I can miss. Like, I don't need to be in West Virginia or Kentucky. I'm good without, like, with missing those. But I would love, 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 love to visit all seven continents, including Antarctica. That would be total bucket list for me. And to take a cruise that's longer than 15 days. Those are probably the ones that come to mind initially.
How many continents have you done so far?
Three. Europe, North and South America.
Where did you go in these places?
Barcelona and Paris, and then Argentina. And actually, I haven't really been out of the country since. It's, you know, I haven't traveled as much abroad as I would have liked in the last couple of years.
Well, you can set that for retirement as a goal.
I guess so, but I have a feeling I'll start traveling soon.
The wanderlust is there?
Oh, absolutely. I remember it took a while for me to get a passport. At the time, I was working at UCLA, and the guy who I considered to be my work husband at the time, he was from Sweden. And he was like, bam, you have to get a passport. Once you get a passport, you can go anywhere. So he basically hounded me until I got one. And I was just so thankful for that. And so now I've got to just renew the thing, you know, just send it off to get the passport renewal. And then I can continue. I mean, one big thing is, like, in between that time, I think you know this, that I'm African-American. But, you know, I had relaxed hair before, and now I have natural hair, you know, so it's just short and curly, whereas before, like, you know, like, just straight, you know, chemically straight. And so, I mean, one of the things I'm like, I finally would like to have my passport picture with how I look right now, because that would be really cool. And it's also a reminder of how long it's been since I went natural. I think that was like 2006. And so it's almost been 10 years.
What made you go natural with it?
You know, it was something that, you know, the woman that was doing my hair in LA, I basically found her like the month after I arrived in LA, and she did my hair for the entire 12 years that I was there. And so she just really convinced me that I could pull it off, that my texture would be fine, that it's such a different, it's such a big deal for Black women to go natural. It's a brave thing because it's already that you stand out, particularly in the workplace, and you're always trying to figure out things that make you less obvious. You know, you just want to, you know, blend in and do your job and not be seen as different. Of course, you know, your skin color sort of betrays you every time. So, you know, at one point, you know, relaxed hair was considered to be more professional, that type of thing. And so going away from that requires some bravery because you have to get used to yourself in a different way, how you look. You know, the people who I say were most, I wouldn't say anybody was negative, but the least supportive was like older Black women. They were like, oh, what happened to all your beautiful hair? You know, as if to say your natural hair is not that beautiful. And so sort of dealing with that feedback, dealing with the image issues, and then, you know, trying to figure out a style of hair that's suitable, you know, suitable for you. And that's individual. To, you know, individual to each person, and then learning to take care of your hair because, you know, from, I don't know, 13 when I, you know, got a relaxer and I thought I was grown, right? And ever since then, I had, like, every 2 weeks, you're in the hairdresser. You know, you're in the beauty shop, you're staying there 3-4 hours, you know, at least, waiting for your hair to get done, and then you leave, you pay this money. You know, when it's time to get your relaxer, your touch-up, it's like, I don't know if you saw Malcolm X, that opening scene of Malcolm X, and, you know, he's getting his hair with lye in it, and, like, you hold on for as long as you can, and then you sort of, you know, it burns. It just burns your scalp. I mean, they have no lye relaxers now, but it's still, the chemical is just hazardous. And so, you know, that just became a part of your life that you have to change. And, you know, if you do your hair yourself and take care of it and see how it grows and see how your texture is, it's just a process. I mean, it was just a one long process.
It becomes part of your routine of life then.
Right, exactly. I mean, now, once I was letting my hair grow out and I was doing a lot of braids, but even braids became a burden, because it was like, okay, it looked good for, you know, 2 months and maybe you can stretch it out to 3 months, but then you have to take it down, right? You have to, because usually when I got my hair braided, I'd have fake hair braided in with my real hair. And so, you know, taking the braids out was an all day ordeal, you know, and I couldn't really go out because I didn't want people to see my hair like that. I mean, and then it's like, then it's another, what, six hours or seven hours to get the hair rebraided. So, I mean, that just became a situation. And so that's when I was like, I'm just going to go back to my short hair. It's much easier for me to maintain. And, you know, for me, I really like the short hair, the shorter haircut.
It all comes down to what you feel most comfortable with.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Like, I found over the last year that looking back on photos of myself, wow, I can't do short hair. It's just not who I am. My stylist was like, no, you need to have longer, shaggier hair. The way I describe it is, let's go 90s grunge. Those are my teen years. Why don't I wear that in my 30s? My goal is that when I go completely gray, I'm going to tie it all back into a ponytail. I want to be that professor on campus walking around going, what's up, my young ones? Let us go under a tree and discuss Walt Whitman now.
Yeah.
But I think I got a few years left before that happens. But you're happy with the shorter hair, and I, you know, yeah. Respect to that, because I can't wear the short hair.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great, because, like, the woman who does my hair now, I mean, who cuts it, she cuts it with scissors, so she blows it out. So it looks short, but when you blow it out, it's like, you know, it's a little, you know, it's a little bit of a fro there. I like that about my stylist now. I mean, you just have a really close relationship with the person who does your hair. It's like, they're doing your hair, but they just get to know you as a person in such a deep way. I don't even know how that happens, but it's like everyone who has someone that, you know, a stylist sort of feels that way. There's just such a connection that is built between that person, you know.
My wife was like, you should go see a stylist. Mm-hmm. And so I started meeting one. Now I have one, and she's a, you know, regular. And yeah, you're right. There creates this bond. Like, they can look at you and go, you can't do this particular hairstyle, but here's what I think we can do with you, and it will work. And then you have, like, long, amazing conversations.
Right. Yeah. I think they just get to know you on a deeper level. It's like, oh no, what's going on with you? Your hair is falling out. Is something wrong? You know, they just know.
You've been under a little more stress. You got a couple more gray here in the temple.
Exactly.
And then when you find one, you follow them no matter where they go in town.
Oh, whatever. I have to follow them. Like, so for right now, my stylist lives in Maryland, but some of her clients convinced her to come back to Durham every month.
To do a couple, you know, to do a special appointment.
Yes. So she comes back every month because, you know, now we've made it worth her while. And it's like, I was going to somebody else. I mean, she was good until, you know, Crystal came back and I was like, oh my gosh. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, once a month, you know, if I have to, you know, use some sick time and go in late or, you know, leave early, I'm doing it. I was like, my stylist only comes in once a month. And people are like, oh yeah. Okay. You need to go.
It's like, you just say that and everybody totally understands.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, the women understand. I don't know what the men think.
Yeah. I just tell them to go find a stylist and they'll understand.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah.
Don't be afraid. Though I will say one of the greatest experiences I've ever had with any barber, I don't know how rare it is now, but one of my barbers before he passed away was one of the old school stylists where he would do a hot lather across the back of the neck into a straight razor.
Oh, to trim it. Gosh, wow, yeah.
And if to our listeners, if you ever get the chance to have that done, it's amazing. I had a friend I told that to, and they was like, I'd be scared witless. I'm like, no, man. Trust me, that feels very, very good to have that close
shave. Yeah, my ex had a barber when he shaved his head, but his barber would do it with a straight razor. I mean, which is like a lot of trust and a lot of skill.
Yeah, I wonder if those old school barbers, how many of them are left?
I don't know. I mean, it's so funny because you say, you know, I don't know, and I wonder if it's a difference. You know, if you go to a black barber, or like, you know, I think about my brother, right? And the guy that he would have cut his hair would only have this guy cut his hair, would wait hours to have this one person cut his hair, or my nephew's hair, something like that. So, I mean, it's just a different experience.
Maybe.
In a way. And, you know, and if you've ever been in, like, to a black barbershop, I mean, if you've ever seen that movie Barbershop, it is pretty much like that. It's totally like that. It's like the BS and the stories and the, you know, it's just totally like that. So it's more like an experience as opposed to, you know, just you going there for a transaction.
You're not just going in for a haircut. You're going in for gossip. You're going in for basically a community center.
Right. Exactly. Right. And I know, like, in LA, I had a couple of friends who did research on barbershops and beauty shops, particularly as a way to do health promotion, you know, so because you had a captive audience and, you know, using barbers and beauticians to encourage people to get mammograms and, you know, their blood pressure checked and things like that. So I know that there was a couple of organizations that did that as well.
It's actually a brilliant idea.
Right. And I mean, and it goes back to the trustworthiness of people. I mean, when you think about particular occupations as being trustworthy, you know, it kind of goes along with that as well. Like teachers, I think people, for the most part, feel teachers are trustworthy individuals.
Lawyers, on the other hand.
Exactly. Lawyers, not so much.
Car salesman, you know.
Car salesman is absolutely not, you know.
Yeah. Well, any salesman. I can't name a salesman I trust. Doesn't matter what they're selling.
Right, right.
Again, so, I come back to my New Yorker. I think that's it. I don't trust anyone.
I mean, but that's helpful, though. I mean, you got to admit, we're not going to be taken advantage of for the most part. Because, you know, somebody sending you that email saying, I'm from whatever country and all I want to do is transfer, you know, $5 million in your bank account. I wonder how many New Yorkers got duped by that one. I'm just saying.
I wonder about that sometimes when I see, like, phishing scams or anything. I'm like, who in the company actually clicked on the link? We've had 20 years of the internet now. I think by now we're all familiar with, if you see a link and they're talking about, like, if you're in a company that says, we will never ask you for your password, who then still clicks on the link?
I know. I mean, people do. People do. There's still a lot of actually older people getting onto the internet who don't recognize this. Like, I remember my mom really started using email a lot. I mean, outside of work, it was, I can't tell you how many of the chain letter things I got, you know, send this to 5 people and you'll have great luck or that type of thing. Oh gosh.
At least it's not like an email with 20 re's and fuds in it. It sounded crazy, but it was worth a shot. That kind of email header. Bah, I got nothing more on that.
I used to get that from, like, Yahoo. Like, oh, your account has been compromised. But then if you just click on the from, it would have, like, somebody's AOL email. Like, this is not from Yahoo, you know?
You could tell, yeah. You know, I'm sorry, but I don't think anybody in this company has swimfan6969 as their actual email address in the company. But yeah, you got to be skeptical to be on the internet.
Yeah, this is true.
Just, you know, so tell my students, man, don't trust anything. Treat everything as lies until you can verify it.
Well, trust but verify. I mean, that's probably the only time you'll hear me quote Ronald Reagan, honestly. But that's real. I mean, I do that in dating. You know, if I've dated a guy or gone out with him a couple of times, then before that third time or around that third time, I'm like, okay, let me try to verify some of the things that you have said. And I mean, last year, that really came into play because this guy told me, oh my God, let me tell you, I met him with some friends of mine, right? We were just out at Barnes & Noble. They struck up a conversation, and I think like he must have mentioned that he has, you know, he's getting a PhD or he has a PhD. And then, you know, my male friend was like, oh, Pam has a PhD, because that's just like nothing that I really put out there. So that's one thing that he said. He said he was building a house in North Raleigh. He said something else. He said he worked for this like pseudo government organization called the Institute of Homeland Security. And, you know, as our conversation, as we went on, it was like, you know, they do research for the government, but they are not a government entity. I forgot what kind of entity he said he was. And, you know, we have all these patents and we sell patents to the defense industry and that's how we get our money. And honestly, I started with where he said he got his PhD, because I used to be in institutional research. So I kind of have heard of a lot of colleges and universities. And so that checked out. But, you know, the whole thing, you know, and I have to say, I am definitely not the person that you want to lie to about things that are publicly available that I can find, you know. So, you know, he said he was building a house in North Raleigh. Okay, that means that you have bought some property, that you should be on the tax record. So I went to the Wake County tax records. Don't see his name. You know, things like that. You say you have a PhD. Well, if you got a PhD in the United States, you know, you wrote a dissertation, it is filed at, what is it called? The place in Michigan. You should be able to look it up. Didn't find him there. I mean, it's like, I could never find the place where he said that he worked. I mean, that place just did not exist. And so it was just like, you know, patents. He's like, said he had a patent, didn't have patents, nothing. Nothing about what he said about him checked out. Like some of the stuff that he said about his personal life had checked out, but it was just like, I so dodged a bullet by being very skeptical, or at least not verifying the stuff that he said. And I tell the story, and when I've told the story, people are like, oh my God, I would have never gone to that extreme. You know, and I don't think of it as extreme, but at the same time, you know, I don't know what would have happened had I not checked it out and realized that this guy was lying. And I think I kind of let him know that I knew he was lying the last time I saw him. And, you know, he just never contacted me again because it was just like, it was just too fishy, you know? Just too fishy.
You got to make your lies plausible. That's the secret to lying good. You got to make them plausible and just enough, you know, you got to know that, okay, this can be publicly verified. So you got to make your lies a little more believable. It's getting tougher to pull that move now, but right. It also depends on the stakes. I lied my ass off at my high school reunion, telling everybody I did different things because I didn't want them to know. And every lie had to be plausible. Like, I am a farmer. You know, another person, I traffic zoo animals.
Right.
I work in Hungarian pornography. You know, just enough knowledge of all these subjects from different research and everything that I could lie credibly. And no one, and since the stakes were low, no one was going to look me up. I feel like we've only just begun to scratch the surface now, because I feel like most guests, we could get into bad dating stories aplenty. Oh, okay. But unfortunately, we're almost out of time.
Gosh, that went by fast.
I know, I'm shocked. I'm like going into this thinking, okay, we're going to talk about, you know, a couple of things. And next thing I know, we're talking about all these amazing things. Before we let you go, though, sure. I know that you have a chapbook out now with Hyacinth Girl.
Yes, Hyacinth Girl Press. And I just want to give a shout out to Margaret Pashar because I know she's been on your show twice. She's just so awesome. I don't know how she really does this one woman show thing, but it's been really great to come out, to have my chapbook come out through them.
That was just a recent release too, just a couple months ago.
Yeah, in I think it was June. It was just June.
Yeah, really recent, because I remember my wife seeing the cover art and going, damn. And she was like, come look at this. I looked down and I went, damn.
Yeah, that one, and that's a local artist in Carrboro, whom I had met at this sort of tribute to Maya Angelou, where I was an MC, and she had done this previous artwork of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And so when it was time to do some cover art, I thought about her and was able to get Joel Morrow to do a cover just for this book. So that's the other really cool part about it.
Wow. It is stunning, and the work is beautiful as well.
Thank you.
So where can the folks find you online?
I have a blog called poetsdoublelife.com. So P-O-E-T-S double life. I'm not going to spell the rest part. .com. And it's my blog because, you know, I have this poetry career, but also have this sort of this non-literary career. Like, right, I work for a state government, which is totally something different. You know, I do mostly data analysis and evaluation, and, you know, have done that for a long time before I even started writing. So it's just sort of the balance of, you know, just trying, how I try to keep connected to the poetry world despite having this other job here. And it's not so much it's in conflict, because, you know, my non-literary career helps me not be poor, and it helps to pay for all the workshops and conferences, you know, that I want to go to, and all the books that I buy that I don't get a chance to read either. So, you know, I'm very thankful and grateful for that.
Are you on the Twitter at all, or other sites, social media?
I'm on Facebook, but I mean, that's just my personal stuff. I mean, Twitter is just too much. It's just too much. And I only joined to follow NASA, honestly. Like NASA and Nat Geo. And I think the NFL is going to start doing Twitter, and I'll probably follow just those three things. That's it.
Well, there's a whole bunch of topics we haven't even begun to address. The science, the NFL, and much, much more. We might have to have you come back sometime, Pamela.
Oh, sure. I would love that.
We'll look into what our schedule is going to be, but it has been a pleasure talking to you today.
All right. Same here, Scott. It's lovely meeting you via Skype.
Via Skype, indeed. And hopefully, who knows, maybe in Los Angeles we'll meet face to face.
Yeah, definitely let me know if you decide.
Will do. Hey, have a great evening.
All right. You too.
Take care.
Bye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.